In the next 45 minutes, we will talk about the concert series Ouverture Spirituelle, which will be open tomorrow with Sofia Gubadulina's Canticle of the Sun and music to accompany a departure with funeral music by Heinrich Schütz, a collaboration with the Los Angeles Master Choral and Peter Sellers. And of course, Peter will tell us about his version of Henry Purcell's last opera, The Indian Queen. Tomorrow starts the Ouverture Spirituelle, a concert series mainly dedicated to sacred and spiritual music from 20th century to the music era of Baroque and Renaissance. The continuous motif is Lux Aeterna, eternal light, which arouses associations to a bright range of sound colors as we find in the very first concert tomorrow at 6:30 at the Felsenreitschule with Olivier Messiaen, Éclair sur l'au-delà, Lightning over the Beyond, with the SWR Symphony Orchestra and Ingo Metzmacher, who also will conduct Falstaff. Markus, could you please tell us some more details on the idea of this year's Ouverture Spirituelle?
Peter, you forgive me that I start in German because, I mean, they're all German speaking. I mean, it's just our politeness to to speak in English, but I don't think that it's any problem. And you understand much better German than people think. Rain is falling. Wow. This is typical Salzburg. Churches, bells, rain. The Ouverture Spirituelle. Die Ouverture Spirituelle, das ist für uns, die wir das planen und die wir das den Menschen anbieten, eine ganz besondere Woche. Es ist die Möglichkeit, zunächst einmal einen Einschwingvorgang zu programmieren, bevor dann ab dem 26., 27. Juli alles anders wird. Dieser Einschwingvorgang ist sehr wichtig. Dieser Einschwingvorgang hat etwas mit einer Auseinandersetzung zu tun. Wir haben die Idee zur Ouverture Spirituelle, das war wirklich eine Königsidee, war ja von Alexander Pereira. Und in der Zeit, in der Pereira Intendant war, hat er sich mit den vier Weltreligionen beschäftigt. Das wollte ich nicht weiterführen, geschweige denn wiederholen. Also wir haben die Ouverture Spirituelle für Ron Wiegand und ich jedes Jahr unter einen bestimmten, wie soll ich, unter einen bestimmten Gedanken gesetzt. Nicht ein Motto, sondern einen Gedanken. Dieses Jahr steht über allem Lux Aeterna. Und das ist sehr interessant für uns, weil wir einerseits uns mit dieser Sehnsucht, auch mit der Bitte nach dem ewigen Licht auseinandersetzen. Lux Aeterna ist ja Teil der Communio, der liturgischen Totenmesche, folgt dem Agnus Dei. Und diese Auseinandersetzung mit einer tief, tief empfundenen Sehnsucht nach einem Jenseits, die eröffnet auch, wie soll ich sagen, oder kann in einem schönsten und bereicherndsten Fall auch einen metaphysischen Raum öffnen. Eine der zentralen Fragen der Metaphysik wurde ja von Leibniz formuliert. Warum ist überhaupt etwas und nicht vielmehr nichts? Das ist eine ganz, ganz entscheidende Frage auch für die Planung und für das, was wir mit der Ouverture Spirituelle erzählen wollen. Warum ist überhaupt etwas und nicht vielmehr nichts? Und wir kommen natürlich auch in eine, für mich als Musiker, auch sehr interessante Situation. Licht funktioniert ja nicht ohne Dunkelheit. Also der Antagonismus zwischen Licht und Dunkelheit ist ganz entscheidend. Das Licht ist etwas, was man nicht hören kann. Ist ausgeschlossen. Aber das Faszinierende ist, dass die Musik immer wieder den Versuch unternommen hat, das Unhörbare in Musik zu übersetzen. Das ist ein fantastischer Vorgang, der meiner Meinung nach durchaus seinen Sehnsuchtsort in der Romantik findet. Und da muss ich ja auch wieder ein kleines Zitat anbringen, nämlich Friedrich Schlegel, der geschrieben hat, reine Musik ist eins mit der Offenbarung des Lichts. Reine Musik ist eins mit der Offenbarung des Lichts. Also diese Frage von Licht und Dunkelheit, diese Frage, was ist das überhaupt, dieses Leben, diese Frage des Öffnens eines metaphysischen Raumes. Und das heißt ja auch nicht viel mehr als, was ist Metaphysik? Die Metaphysik geht den Fragen nach des Seins. Warum sind wir? Woher kommen wir? Was ist der Sinn dieser Existenz, der wir manchmal auch ausgeliefert sind. Und wo liegen die, wo liegt die Überschreitung der Grenzen sinnlicher Erfahrung? Das ist ganz entscheidend auch für die Fragen, die wir in der Ouverture spirituell stellen. Und wir beginnen ja auch mit diesem von dir eben erwähnten großen Werk von Olivier Messiaen. Und am gleichen Abend haben wir das Glück, die Auseinandersetzung von Peter Sellers zu erleben mit den musikalischen Exequien von Heinrich Schütz und dem Sonnengesang von Sofia Gubadolina für Cello, Schlagzeug und Chor. Und auch da, und Peter Sellers wird ja viel dazu zu sagen, aber auch da spielt dieser Antagonismus von Dunkelheit und Licht eine Rolle. Es ist ein großer, großer Aggregatzustand, der da in diesem Abend formuliert wird. Ein ziemlich extremer Aggregatzustand auch. Und Peter Sellers ist ja seit, ja Gott, nun mal fast 30 Jahren ein wirklicher Freund der Festspiele. Und wenn wir über die Ouverture spirituell sprechen, dann kann das gar nicht ohne Peter Sellers passieren, weil Peter Sellers eben in diesen Jahrzehnten der Präsenz und der Freundschaft zu den Salzburger Festspielen auch, und das über, damit übertreibe ich gar nicht, auch ein Teil des spirituellen Zentrums der Festspiele war und immer noch ist. Vielleicht war er der, das Epizentrum der Spiritualität. Peter. You understand very well. I mean, it's fantastic how you follow me. I was waiting for your love.
Good morning, everybody. Hello. Nice to see everyone. Welcome to the Salzburg Festival. Just to say, of course, as Marcus said, I came here 30 years ago with St. Francis and Messiaen. And of course, other composers worked on Messiaen in our lifetime. Sofia Gubadolina made this incredible setting of the Canticle to the Sun of St. Francis. And of course, even we only have to say the word and now the sun comes out. But just to say, this is this beautiful song of St. Francis, which moves across time and across space and into your life, daily life, every day. Gubadolina has made something that is spiritually shimmering and alive and that really, like her music, cuts through the flesh and opens every part of you and another world rushes in. It's music of such incredible ecstasy, such incredible surrender, such incredible wildness. And this woman really knows that music is wilder than words are. And that the words of St. Francis are an invitation to live a life that is much wilder and less selfish and narrow, but really open and fearless. So this music is very, very fearless. She sets this piece for a cello solo that is heroic, really heroic and shamanic. And the whole piece is a kind of ritual calling the sun, like every culture in history, this ritual of how do you bring a new day into being? Because at 4 a.m, it's very dark. And what brings the sun back? So this prayer is a very special prayer. Gubadolina has chosen the cello, an instrument of darkness, to open it into an instrument of light. And this light in darkness that is Marcus is speaking about so eloquently, this, of course, the darkness is, the light shining out of darkness is in your heart. And Gubadolina takes the cello, this heartfelt instrument of darkness that we know from the Bach suites of Someone Alone, and surrounds them with a chorus. And so it's a Bach suite with a lot of other people present. And those chorus is humming and sometimes just on the syllable. Ah, the syllable of discovery, the syllable of openness, opening. This chorus is creating an opening and percussion is there with the cello to crack open everything that is closed. And you hear these incredible shocking bursts of percussion that say, no, no, like the thunder, like the lightning, this will be opened. Everything that is closed. And then the percussion also has these incredible long periods playing in the glass harmonica, you know, the glasses filled with water, and these long, strange curtains of marimba and celeste, which create this night sky of millions and millions of stars. So it's such an incredible vision. And the music is very visual and very visceral. And this is Marcus's genius, is to say, please do this to open the festival. And so that is the first part of the program. And the second part of the program is something that I've been working on for the last 3 years during COVID. It's a piece rather well known in Germany, but in Los Angeles less well known, of Heinrich Schütz, the Musikalische Exequien, which we translate in English as music to accompany a departure. In my own life, in my 20s, I was, normally the director hires singers. In this case, the singers hired me. And I worked with a group of singers in Boston for 10 years at Emmanuel Church, where they did a Bach cantata every Sunday. And so all of our rehearsals were in between Bach rehearsals. And Bach was the main activity. They did and they're still doing the Bach cantatas now for more than 50 years, every Sunday. So that was the basis. And Craig Smith, who I worked with very closely, the music director, loved Heinrich Schütz. So we had Schütz motets constantly. When COVID began and we were all at home a couple of years ago in February and March, and the assignment was just to be quiet, which for human beings is very hard. Can you just stop and be quiet? That's the real assignment now. Stop. Please just stop. And so I was at home in California, and I began listening to all of Schütz, which is a lot. And then about towards the end of February, I came upon this Musikalische Exequien, and I said, this is the music for this moment. And the moment, we didn't know how deep it would continue to get. And I called Grant from the Los Angeles Master Chorale and said, do you know this piece? And he said, no, I don't know any Schütz. So, because that's not the tradition in Los Angeles at all. But just to say quickly, for me, this music is very special because Heinrich Schütz, as a young man, apprenticed to Gabrielli at the San Marco Cathedral in Venice and was obsessed with this antiphonal writing with multiple orchestras, multiple choruses from all directions, this 360-degree music. Immersive, as they say. And for hundreds of musicians. And he went back to Germany and brought this. And he, as you know, his Psalms of David are for these incredible combinations of choir upon choir and just thrilling. And then in the 1630s, the 30 Years' War began and the plague. And suddenly you couldn't have hundreds of musicians. And by the end of his life, Heinrich Schütz, in his 80s, wrote his St. Matthew Passion, his St. John Passion, his St. Luke Passion, his St. Mark Passion, each of those for 5 musicians. The man who started working with 500 musicians. And not only was it budget cuts, it was war and huge numbers of people dying. One of Schütz's friends, a local elector in Dresden, said, I know I'm dying. Would you please write the music for my funeral? And Schütz said, let's work on it together. And so in the last months of this man's life, they went through sacred texts and chose theological texts, hymns, Martin Luther, 27 sentences. The gentleman who is leaving the world hired an artist, a sculptor, to sculpt a coffin out of copper and carve these sentences into the coffin. So one sentence is over the head, another over the heart, another over the hands, another over the feet. So the whole body is a preparation for death already. When the man died, he was placed in the coffin, and Schütz created this little modest setting for a small group of singers. The Italian Mass, as you know, is a giant bucket that you can put anything into, and it holds everything. Schütz created this opposite. 27 sentences, two people come forward and sing their little sentence and step back. One person steps forward and sings their little sentence and steps back. Then the whole chorus sings Erbarmendich for 20 seconds. And you have the first German requiem. This very modest, quiet piece of a small group of people mourning a friend. And the second part of the piece, the group gathers on either side of the coffin and sings a small motet to each other across the coffin. And then the third piece is Schütz touching his Venice background. And a very small group is left singing around the coffin. And as they're singing around the coffin, they begin to hear voices coming from everywhere. And the whole room is filled with voices, and you can't see where they're coming from. You just hear that we're not alone. And this music, Schütz makes it not symmetrical, so it's not call and response. You don't know where you are, like certain movements in Bach, where he deliberately says, is that a repeat? Are we continuing? Is this new material? You can't tell where you are. You're in a new landscape where the beginning and the ending are no longer visible. Anyway, just to say, for all of us, Los Angeles was one of the real epicenters of the plague in America. And Phoenix, a lot of these cities were just catastrophic. We all lost a lot of people. I lost my father that January. But none of us could say goodbye. I could not go near him. Nobody could go into that hospital. And all these millions of people left with nobody saying goodbye. And families couldn't say goodbye to anyone. And nobody to this day knows how to talk about what happened. Our inability to talk about it and just say, oh, let's move on, we're back to normal. Excuse me, we are not. Whatever normal was. We still haven't even addressed what we've lived through when that many people left the world. No politician knows how to talk about it. No hospital knows how to talk about it. And the families who've been through it don't know how to talk about it. So for me, I wanted this last 2 years in Los Angeles to make a ceremony for the people we lost and that we couldn't say goodbye to, and create a moment where we just say goodbye, because everybody left with nobody saying goodbye. So the Schütz is a small gathering of people. And with the Master Chorale, we had very intense rehearsals, and I asked them simply to say goodbye to people they were unable to say goodbye to. And so the piece evolved from people's personal situations and stories and what we went through these last 2 years. And the music of Schütz created a place that we didn't have, none of us had. And this connection to something, again, that America is not good at acknowledging, that it's a plague and a war happening at the same time. So you're losing people in both directions. And this piece is well known in Germany, but I will say there are many, many recordings of it by wonderful people who have performed this piece in the last few years in the Salzburg Festival in the Overture Spirituelle. But in all the recordings, the music is about 35 minutes long. This performance is about 80 minutes long. Because the minute you understand this as an actual memorial service, and you behave the way you do in a memorial service, this music is a very, very different experience. It's not early music. It's not a little choral concert. It's something else. And when you sing the music at the pace you're saying goodbye to somebody, which, as you all know, when someone's at the end of their life and you're trying to say goodbye to them, and you have one sentence to work with, and you try to pass the sentence back and forth between the person who's leaving and the person who's trying to say, please stay or go ahead and leave, I'm with you. That sentence becomes very, very powerful. And when you say it, you don't just repeat it. It means very different things because that's the only sentence you have to say a lot of things with. So the piece has a lot of spaciousness and a lot of silence because we're in front of something that we also must simply be silent in front of. And then when Schütz finds the music and finds the words, it's quite a deep, deep relief. So what is happening with the music is just I invited people to put their bodies inside this music and the bodies of their friends inside this music and the bodies of their family. So it's a very lived-in experience. And we did it in Los Angeles in November, and it's just very, very emotional. Very, very emotional. But it's a space to put emotions that we're still holding, but we've never been able to release.
Thank you, Peter. May I add that the LA Master Choral will be staged together with musicians from Austria. With a very very young and very good cellist, Julia Hagen.
Julia is beyond belief.
Yeah.
She is just spectacular. Oh, my God.
Yes, because you mentioned the
shaman energy and that she is it. She really, she just like the lightning, she just cuts right through from heaven to earth. She's incredible. She's incredible. And she pours her whole being, she pours her whole being into this music. It's overwhelming. Really, really overwhelming.
Yes, and the two percussionists, Christoph Sietzen and Bogdan Bajanu.
Which, they have the craziest job because it's, again, Gubaidulina always is asking you for more than you think you can give, which is the sign of real music. And when you find that in yourself to give it, something amazing happens.
Thank you. Yeah, and the... Um den Bogen zu schließen von der Ouvertüre Spirituelle, sie wird schließen dann am 30. Juli mit den Wiener Philharmonikern und Christian Thielemann, auch mit einem Requiem, nämlich dem von Brahms. Max, magst du noch etwas ergänzen? Es war
Peter ist ein großes Glück in jeder Hinsicht. Ich möchte dir nicht vorgreifen, aber ich glaube, es wäre sehr, sehr wichtig und interessant und faszinierend zu hören, was Peter Sellers zu diesem Wunderwerk der Indian Queen zu sagen. Das ist eine wirklich hochgerühmte, wichtige Inszenierung gewesen, die er in Madrid gemacht hat. Theodor Korenzis war damals auch der Dirigent. Wir haben jetzt hier eine konzertante Situation, aber auch da, was für ein Glück, dass Peter da ist. Er wird schon seine Augen und seine Ohren in der Felsenreitschule haben. Die Felsenreitschule sind seine Augen, seine Ohren. Er hat vorhin den Beginn hier in Salzburg erwähnt, die erste Inszenierung Saint-François d'Assise von Olivier Messiaen. Und ich habe das oft gesagt, diese Inszenierung hat mein Leben verändert. Also, um es auf den Punkt zu bringen, wahrscheinlich würde ich jetzt nicht das Privileg haben, hier zu sitzen neben Peter und mit Ihnen zu reden, wenn ich das nicht erlebt hätte damals. Und ich habe es oft gesehen, wirklich oft gesehen. Und ich war, es war eine Mischung von dem Erkennen, was Musiktheater sein kann, was Musiktheater mitteilen kann und mitteilen muss, welche Dringlichkeit, die über alle Sphären hinausgeht, dieses Werk von Messiaen in der Interpretation von Peter Sellers hat und natürlich dann auch von Isabel Kassalonen. Das war so, und Dawn Upshaw und José van Damme, das war für mich wirklich da hat sich eine Welt eröffnet, über die ich bis heute nachdenke, die bis heute so, so tief und präsent in mir ist. Also allein dafür bin ich dir für immer und immer und immer dankbar, Peter, neben vielen, vielen anderen auch. Aber wie gesagt, Indian Queen ist ein sehr, sehr, sehr wichtiges Stück. Über die Wesentlichkeit dieses Stückes wird ja niemand besser Bescheid geben können als du, Peter. So, stell deine Fragen, bitte.
Maybe let's have a look back at the year 2011. I think then you started to think about Purcell's The Indian Queen, his last opera, which is not finished.
You know, the reason, first of all, Marcus, you coming to St. Francis, that was also very important. That was overwhelming. But just to say, and there's only one piece in the world like that, you know, that's an experience, you know, there's nothing like that. But just to say, nonetheless, there are these composers who have this spiritual energy, and Henry Purcell is right there in a very intense life, because he, like Mozart and Schubert and so on, he left at the age of 35, and he had a life work. His life work was, he was born just after Cromwell was deposed in England, but the previous era between Henry Purcell and going back to Shakespeare were the Puritans, who forbade music in the church and closed all the theaters. So there was no music in England for two generations. And then Purcell, at the age of 20, was made the organist and music director of Westminster Abbey. And the future of English church music was handed to this young man, after a silence of two generations. Purcell's first teacher when he was 12 was Pelham Humphreys, who was a student of Lully. His second teacher when he was 13 was John Blow, who wrote the first opera in English, Venus and Adonis. So you're at a period where music is being reinvented from nothing. And you feel Purcell making this courageous gesture of saying, where do we start? Both in the theater, where he wrote hundreds of theater songs and scored maybe about 70 plays. And the British theater, the Restoration Theater in England, was crazy. Every play was set in some crazy part of the world. The Indian Queen was the Mayas versus the Incas. What? Like, all of it was crazy. But that interested them. But also, because of the religious orthodoxy of the Puritans, the English theater of this time loved making tragedies and comedies set in China, in Africa, in Latin America, where they could put pagan ceremonies on stage that were not Christian. And all of these incredible rituals. And so Purcell is writing these amazing Mayan rituals and beginning English church music from zero. So this, in his lifetime, it's really an astonishing thing what he achieved. And he starts with, like anybody dealing with budget cuts, coming after a terrible period, because of course Purcell, when he was six, was the plague, the London plague, and when he was seven, the fire of London, which destroyed I think one quarter of the population of London when in his childhood was died. So Purcell also was coming out of these plague years. So the music is like Schütz. So much of the music is a cappella because there's no instruments, there's nobody. And so the music is, a lot of it is a cappella, the choral music. And the theater music is making crazy racket with a small group of people. You know, and it's improvised, and it has all of these wild elements to it. Purcell died, famously, at the age of 35, while he was writing Indian Queen, in the midst of writing Indian Queen. It was never finished. Also, the theater that put it on, because there were only allowed to be two theaters, and they were rivals, and this piece was stolen to the rival theater, and there were none of Purcell's normal people put it on, so young people who didn't know what they were doing, so there's not even a record of the first performance. We don't know anything about it, really. We do know while he was writing it, the legend is he went home late at night in a bad weather, and the door was locked, and he pounded on the door, and it did not open, and he froze to death on the stairs in front of his house. So that tells you a little something about why the two words that are most often set in Purcell are never, 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 and nothing, nothing, nothing. There's a dark streak in Purcell, which is like the Samuel Beckett. The word nothing comes over and over again. And like the Gershwins, all the love music is in the negative. He loves and she loves and they love, so why can't you love and me love too? Everything is heartbreaking because it's stated negatively. And this yearning, the Sehnsucht that Marcus speaks of, is in Purcell in a way that's unbearable. And this unbearable yearning for love, and also from a city that has to rebuild itself from ashes. That's what you feel in this music. But Theodore Kurrensis and I met thanks to Gerard Mortier, who said we must work together. We worked on Tchaikovsky's Iolanta and Stravinsky's Persephone. And in the first rehearsals, Theodore said to me, "Do you know Indian Queen of Purcell?" And when Theodore asks a question like that, you don't fool around. He means it. He looks at you with his laser eyes, goes right through you, say, "Do you know the Indian Queen of Purcell?" Yeah. So anyway, I was obsessed with the Indian Queen when I was in my 20s, because for one thing, I had no money, and this was cheap, I thought. I could do this really cheaply. And then... But I thought, why is this person coming from Russia and Greece obsessed with the Indian Queen? And it's because Andrei Tarkovsky, the great Russian filmmaker, was never admitted to film school in Russia. So he chose to go to a music conservatory instead. And he specialized, because he couldn't stand official 19th century Russian culture, in early music. Now, what early music meant in Moscow in the 50s and early 60s, I mean, my God. And so the reason why every Tarkovsky movie has Bach and Baroque music is because that's what he studied in school. And so in Mirror, in one of the most powerful emotional sequences in Mirror, deep poetry, an orchestra plays the last song from the Indian Queen of Henry Purcell. And every artist, musician, philosopher, and writer in Russia says, what is the Indian Queen of Henry Purcell? That this great moment in Russian culture emerges from this one aria in the Indian Queen. And of course, Tarkovsky could never put the words of any of these pieces, because censorship would not allow them. So for Russian artists, the Indian Queen is this secret grail that contains everything that can't be spoken and everything that you only imagine. And that this strange music written in 1680 in England can say in Moscow in the 70s. So we began working on it. And I said to Gerard, could we work on this? Of course, Gerard hated baroque music over and over again. He said, okay, if you must. You know. And then what we did with Indian Queen, because it was unfinished, we all know Dido and Aeneas. It's one of the greatest operas ever written. It was made for a girls' school. It lasts 45 minutes. But it's heartbreaking. And it does end with that classic personal heartbreak of Dido's lament. And I thought, what would happen if this guy wrote a four-hour opera, like a full evening opera? And we know he wrote the King Arthur and the Fairy Queen, these crazy things that have all kinds of non sequiturs and dance, then visual things, then a chorus, then a pornographic song, all kinds of crazy things next to each other. For 4 hours, because there was no television. So in that 17th century, opera was the television. You went every night, and all kinds of things happened on stage. So I thought, what if he could have written, like Charpentier, in the same era, the first English opera that was consequential and that had this full evening of emotion? And so Theodore said, please, let's find the music. So I went through all of Purcell's theater music, which is incredible, an incredible range. And so we know Purcell's theater songs when people give Baroque recitals with a lute. But because it's not a theater piece, you don't really know what the words are doing. And suddenly when you hear Purcell's theater music in a theatrical piece, you go, oh my God, the emotion is incredible. And then his sacred music had to be included. Now, I would just say what I couldn't use is any of the text of the what Purcell wrote frequently were semi-operas, they were called. The text is spoken by actors, and then suddenly singers arrive and sing the songs. And two people play the same role. There's an actor who plays the role and the singer who plays the role. And you have this incredible thing of it's spoken for a while, and then suddenly a singer shows up and says, and this is what I would sing. So it has this amazing double vision, which is, again, like Beckett or something. It feels, it's really an amazing theater experience. Just to say, the text by Dryden and this guy, Robert Howard, about the Incas and the Aztecs fighting is horrible. It's just really, I'm sorry, this is a service to future generations to remove this text from this music. And so, meanwhile, of course, growing up in America in the Reagan years when we were attacking Nicaragua, of course, we suddenly said, we have to learn what Nicaragua is. And we were all looking at Nicaraguan art, reading Nicaraguan literature, trying to find Nicaraguan music. We were trying to say, what is the Reagan administration not telling us about Nicaragua? Well, everything. But also, who are these people as people? You know, for me, it's one of the most horrifying things that my country has spent trillions of dollars in Afghanistan for more than a decade, creating a level of poverty and desolation now that you can't imagine. And yet not one American knows one thing about Afghan culture. We don't know who these people are as people. So for me, in those years in the 80s, it was important to know who are Nicaraguans as people. So one of my favorite novelists is this incredible Rosario Aguilar, and she wrote a novel about women in the conquista when the Spanish invaded. And as you know, the conquista is probably the most violent, bloody moment in human history. I mean, it's unbelievable. What were women doing in this time? Rosario Aguilar went to the archives in Latin America to find what women were doing, and in fact, there was nothing. There's one figure, La Malinche, who was the translator between Cortez and Montezuma, and she has legends, but what were the other women doing? So Rosario wrote what was not in the archive, and she created a story of an Indian woman who was sent to, married to Cortez's, the head of Cortez's army, Pedro de Alvarado, and they had fabulous sex, and he was so handsome, and she fell in love with him. And they had beautiful children, and she was supposed to be a double agent and report everything back to her father, the chief of the tribe, and she stopped reporting. She fell in love with him. He was handsome. And then he just simply threw her away. Brought in a bride from Spain. And she existed not even as a concubine. Meanwhile, they had a beautiful daughter. And the daughter grew up in the Catholic Church, could not speak her mother's language, and never would speak to her mother ever. That's the story of two generations of women in one conquista, the Indian queen. So I called Rosario in Nicaragua. She said, please, please, please make this project. And she gave us permission to use her book. And so we have a narration in between the new Purcell music. We created a completely new plot. The plot comes from Rosario. And Rosario came to the premiere with Gerard Mortier in Madrid with seven women in her family to make this big feminist statement, three of her daughters and four of their female children. So it was these seven Nicaraguan women showing up in Madrid. It was quite fantastic as an answer to Spain. It was thrilling. Anyway, so it's a living work, and it's a work that has lots of connections to our own lifetime, of course, but it lets Purcell's music have this emotional range that is not in the Dryden, and lets Purcell write music that goes, you suddenly hear all these levels that were not permitted in 17th century theater, and yet it's in, of course, it's in this music. Theodore was super. We had this period, we worked together in PAM for 3 months putting this project together. We had a group of singers, and Theodore for the first week just made every singer sing every piece and said, well, that's better for you, or this is better for you. And gradually that created the musical landscape. And of course we worked with this amazing, it was my first experience with the incredible choir of Musica Eterna at that time. And we spent, I just kept adding more choral music because this choir was so amazing. They could do anything. And so you're hearing the Purcell choral music because we fell in love. There's a lot of beautiful choral music for them to sing. And the final aria is They Tell Us, which you will hear sung by Jeanique Dubique, right? Anyway, just to say, they tell us, you mighty powers above, make suffer the spirits who are taken by love. And it's this Sehnsucht, it's one of the greatest arias ever written. It's heartbreaking. It repeats over and over again. It's beyond words. And so Theodore does, we do in the performance, you'll hear, there is a big middle section of it where the singer is silent and the orchestra plays it. And you hear this huge, beautiful version for strings that echoes Tarkovsky's Mirror.
Thank you. Markus, some more words on that?
Ich kenne meine Grenzen. Nein, also nach Peter Sellers, das kann man gar nichts dazu sagen. Das war sehr, sehr schön. Danke, Peter. Thank you so much.
No, it's so beautiful to be here.
Yeah,
so
it's for us, it's also very, very beautiful that you're here. Really, really, you're incomparable. Incomparable. I had this kind of silly association we spoke about 30 years ago. And there's a very famous record by the Beatles It's called Sergeant Pepper's. It was 20 years ago today Sergeant Pepper's told the band to play. It's 30 years ago today Peter Sellers told the band to play, and it's still going on. I mean, it's fantastic.
Maybe I should, may I make one little adjustment from what I just said? I said Gerard Mortier did not like baroque music, which which of course is a little bit of a famous truth.
And he didn't like rock music.
Yes.
Not baroque, and not rock
right.
Music.
But I will say, maybe some of you know the Purcell beautiful meditation, O Solitude. It's perhaps one of the most sublime pieces of music, and it's a woman alone. And in terms of music that touches melancholy, it's unsurpassed. And it's about the beauty of solitude. And we have the wife of the Spanish grandee, the Spanish governor, alone in the rainforest, sing O Solitude. And Theodore had this just incredible Russian soprano who just went up and up and up and up and up. And in the last months of Gerard's life, he sat there at the dress rehearsal and with O Solitude, he was really overwhelmed. And he said, I've heard an angel. So Gerard did make a little connection also to this music.
Thank you so much.